Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hi, before we start the show, let's talk about our Patreon page. If you're sick and tired of the commercials on the show, like the one I'm reading right now, I've got a solution for you. For just $15 per month, you can get the Ultimate Edition of this podcast. Here's what that means. The Ultimate Edition combines the free version of the show with the post-mortem show that we record after the end credits. Plus, we take out all the commercials just for you. That means you get the hour-long free show, plus the 20-minute post-mortem show where all the real fun happens, and you get all of that without commercials for just $15 per month. That's support for this fully independent podcast. That's BobSeskaShow.com, or just click the all caps Patreon link beneath the logo at BobSeska.com. And now, let the cartoons begin.
Recorded live in the USA, covering the whole wide world.
Right on!
This is the Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, May 5, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. So today I thought we'd have an encore presentation of my interview with my friend and radio mentor, the great Buzz Burbank, also known as Mike Elston. This is especially for those of you who are just now discovering our podcast and want to know, who's that guy with the dad jokes on your Tuesday podcast? So on today's show, we'll talk with Buzz about his career covering the news every day for the last several decades and how he got started and how he eventually ended up on the Don and Mike show and soon after that in the brand new universe of podcasting. Meantime, if you like what you hear today, don't forget to subscribe to our bonus content at patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. Okay, here's our encore interview with the great Buzz Burbank.
When you say Buzz Burbank,
you've said it all.
So, I guess we'll start here. Exactly how many years were you doing the news total? In fact, I found as I was writing that piece last week for your last News and Comment podcast, Buzz, that I wanted to write the number of years you had been in broadcasting, but I didn't know the total number. And also, I wasn't sure if you even wanted me to reveal the total number. Like,
sure.
Like, yeah. How, like your birth date. You know, no one wants to like make public their age after a certain point. So
I know, and I'm at that point, but there's really no hiding it based on when things happened in my life. Yeah, I decided 50 years was too much, so I quit at around 49.
There you
I
go.
I think around 49 years.
Yeah.
Close, better part of a half century, certainly.
Gotcha.
And so I can say I'm sort of proud of that, even though that automatically makes me old. I'm proud of the career that was so lucky, so incredibly lucky, especially considering where I came from. I'd say in hindsight, I wish I'd been born and raised in New York City because I think my career would have taken, I don't know, I just think it would have started sooner and gone faster and farther if that had happened. But as it was, I was born and raised in Wichita, Kansas, where at the time I got a fine education somehow and, started college when an out-of-town radio job swept me away. I started at, wow, you know, I mean, I was always interested in radio.
In fact,
MTV.
What first inspired you? I mean, what was there a thing? Because, I remember for me, it was like, you know, as soon as I watched WKRP, I said, right. You know what, Dr. Johnny Fever, I want to be Dr. Johnny Fever. That's what I said when I was 8 years old or whatever it was. What was the first spark that said, hey, I like that. I want to do that.
You know, I didn't know what else to do, I guess. I mean, I applied at the radio station I had sort of grown up listening to.
Ah, okay.
A top 40 station. Mm. When I was a kid, and I mentioned this on my final newscast, it was my mom who spent a lot of time reading with me, to me, and eventually let me take over. And so in 1958, when I started kindergarten or thereabouts, I was way ahead of the other kids in terms of reading and reading aloud and reading aloud with meaning.
Wow.
And I just got it, you know, from the very beginning. So language, guys, language is vital for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because as Kennedy said, I think, to communicate is the beginning of understanding.
Yes.
So to me, communication is just absolutely everything, and clarity of communication.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom listened. We had an old radio on the kitchen counter, and my mom listened to the Morning Mayor or whatever it was, you know, back in the day. And one day we got on a bus for a dime and went downtown and saw the Morning Mayor broadcasting live from a sidewalk in front of a dime store. That was kind of cool.
Yeah. And you know what? When I first started my first paid job, there was a guy on that radio station, WEEU in Reading, Pennsylvania. There was a guy called the Night Mayor. And I never understood what that was. What is a mayor on the radio?
Well, it's the guy in charge. It's the
main guy.
The top dude in town.
Ah.
And so if you're the Morning Mayor, if you're a morning DJ and you're the Morning Mayor, that you're the top morning man in town. And I mean, self-proclaimed, of course, but I think it happened to be true.
Yeah.
And that emanated from a 3-call letter station, KFH, which stood for Kansas Finest Hotel, ostensibly. But it was back in the days when they actually had three, and it still has those 3-call letters today. And there are other stations around the country with just 3-call letters, but they're rare. That station I would end up being at later in high school on the FM side.
Wow.
I started out at one point. My dad bought me a Crystal radio set. You build it yourself, only he built it for me, being a former air traffic controller for the Air Force in Korea.
Yeah.
I watched him build it. And then I spent many, many hours listening to it. And that's when I listened to KLEO, a top 40 radio station. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, I got to love the music and the DJs and what they did and talking up records. And I was also fascinated by theater of the mind, and that would come in handy later. But I remember sitting in the junior high or high school library in their audio room listening to Orson Welles' 1939 broadcast of War of the Worlds.
Wow.
And just being awestruck by what you could do with radio theater and what the power of the theater of the mind.
Yeah, there's something addictive about that too, yeah, isn't there? Yeah. Being on the air. It's just once you're on the air once, you've got to, oh my God, I've got to inject that into my veins every day now.
And I started showing interest in broadcasting and practicing it, and it sort of came naturally to me.
Yeah.
I had an opportunity I went to a radio station, a college radio station in my town, KMUW-FM, funny little station. At the time, its equipment was poor, to say the least, and we actually had to sign off when it rained because when the tower got wet from the rain, our signal would begin to drift up and down the dial, which the FCC frowns upon.
Yeah, I imagine.
And so do people trying to keep up with the station.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to sign up. But I was there one day. A friend was doing a Saturday morning music show, and I stopped by to see the place and hang out with the friend. And the friend says to me, news time is coming, and the guy isn't here yet.
Hmm.
And so I thought, well, you know, I know a little bit about this. I'll go into the newsroom and kind of get him set up.
Yeah.
You know, and now you rip the wire and sorted the stories into stacks of local, state, national weather, sports, all that. So it'll all be handy and the most recent stacked on top. And it was just all right there for who.
And this is all like an old teletype, right? This is like it's automatically getting beamed down, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And so the guy never comes. And it's news time, and my friend says, you want to do it? And I said, sure. And so I went, I put together the stories that I thought were important in the order I thought they ought to be to make a newscast, like a real newscast, and I did it.
Wow.
And I finished, and it went pretty well. And I stood up, and I opened the door from the booth, and the program director of that station was standing there. And he looked at me and said, who are you?
Was it in a positive light, or was he about to call security?
I couldn't tell at the time, but as it turned out, it was a positive. It was in a positive light. I think he was prepared to go either way. I think that could have gone either way, but he was okay with what I'd done on the radio. And so then I started applying at the radio station. I applied once and put on my suit, and the bus took me out to the outskirts of Wichita, if you can imagine. You've seen the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm in my little suit walking through the heat and the dust to the radio station.
It's like the radio station in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, right?
Exactly.
That's the radio station I'm thinking of.
If you merged those two movies, then that would depict it. And the first time I applied there, I didn't get hired. The program director, and this was my first evidence that program directors often don't know what they're talking about. Program director informed me that I didn't emphasize the verbs enough. I walked to the store. And I knew that was wrong.
Yeah.
So I didn't get the job, but I also knew not to take his advice. And on another occasion, I would apply there again and instantly get hired. It's really who they need at the time. And I started out as a street reporter. No, I started out as a weekend anchor. Mm-hmm. And so I made like $1.30 an hour for a 5-hour shift one day a week. I was working at a drugstore through the week as a clerk.
Yeah.
So this I did on the weekends, and then one day the street reporter got the newsmobile. We had a little Volkswagen newsmobile with a big antenna on it and the whole thing, and he wrecked it, and that's when the police discovered he didn't have a driver's license.
No.
And so they came to me and said, you want to be a field reporter? And I said, well, sure. And so I added that to my duties. I was still a weekend anchor, but also a field reporter. And eventually that morphed into like an afternoon drive news shift. And I got sort of famous. I would meet at that radio station a Methodist minister who was super cool, super hip guy. He did a talk show and ultimately more than one there. And I ended up working with him very closely. And he and I became great friends. We covered rock concerts together, outdoor rock festivals. We did a series of specials on the prison system. He hosted a Sunday evening talk show called The Wallpaper Session that had higher ratings than its biggest competition at that time on any media, which was the ABC television Sunday night movie. Mm. So we beat all of television and including the top show.
That's incredible.
At the time with this little talk show he did. And then he left the show, and I took over. I was the producer, and I took over as host when he left, and I learned a great deal from him. That same Methodist minister would later marry me and Marsha.
How old were you at that point?
Oh, I'm like, I estimating 20.
20, and then covering rock festivals. I can only imagine how much of a bummer that must have been. festival.
Got to meet Wolfman Jack. I remember the special that I edited together, and it just started out something like it was a montage of various people speaking or yelling. And I think it starts out with Wolfman Jack saying, I want you to put your hands on the radio, and I guarantee you're going to feel him. And then it's followed by a woman screaming, ice cold orange juice for acid freaks. Get it before you're too burned out. And that was how the special started out. And so a lot of fun there. And I learned so much, and so many people helped me. And it was there that I decided that there was value in making friends in those situations with the younger people who would come in after me. Because my thought was, when I was old and decrepit, they would hire me. They would employ me somewhere if I made a good impression on the new people that were coming in. And, you know, that philosophy was still at work when I met you.
okay, gotcha.
You know, and look at us now.
Yeah, right. It worked out quite well, I think. Yeah,
it did indeed.
Yeah,
and then one day I got a call from when I signed on there, I signed off as Mike Elston, and the DJ that sat next to me, the glass was between us instead of us facing each other. We were really side by side with the glass between us. We could turn and look at the other guy, and he banged on the window and hit the intercom. And said, what's your middle name? What's your middle initial? And I said, J. And he said, oh, use that. He said, Boss Jock is all the rage in Los Angeles. And he said, there's a guy out there called J. Paul Huddleston who signs off his newscasts with, this is J. Paul Huddleston, 2020 News. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. So it became, and the format of the radio, all of the news anchors were to end their newscast saying, have a good day.
Yeah.
That was the format. And so when I took it, I signed off with Michael J. Elston, KLAO News, have a good day, and became known, as you and I have discussed before, as the have a good day guy.
Right.
I would go in and write checks, you know, Michael J. Elston. They go, oh, you're the have a good day guy.
That's amazing.
And I had a Q rating or whatever. I had the about the highest in town, if not the highest in town, before I would leave there and get called away. That same disc jockey who'd pounded on the window and said I should change my name had moved to New Orleans and was working at a big station there. He knew of an opening at another station in the town and got me in there. And so I moved from this isolated life that I'd lived in Wichita, Kansas, where I was about to become a big fish in a little pond, to what I really wanted to do, which was move up in market size, because in those days, that's how you got ahead. Radio's changed since then. Boy, has it ever changed.
Yeah, no
doubt. But at the time, that's how the game was played. And New Orleans was a larger market than Wichita, Kansas, obviously, and an exotic place that I couldn't wait to explore, and it was wonderful. I love New Orleans to this day. And I worked with an amazing conglomerate of people there. These names, I don't know if they'll mean anything to anybody listening, but Buzz Bennett was an insane, legendary program director I worked for a while. Kevin Matheny, who would later be known as Pig Vomit, thanks to it, was the program director there for a while.
And you're still in touch with him, right? You're still kind of connected.
Sadly, I wish that I were. Kevin has passed. Kevin is no longer with us.
Okay,
but. We were great friends for many years, and he would hire me again later at another station in Philadelphia. But New Orleans was a blast, and Tom Birch, who is now a very famous consultant, was one of the program directors or music director there. E. Alvin Davis, a disc jockey I had listened to in Wichita when I was a kid, was also there. I mean, I was amazed at this collection of talent that I was among. And so I learned a lot, and that was a big deal. And it was there in New Orleans that the National Association of Broadcasters would hold its convention.
Oh,
so
yeah.
My two tips to young aspiring broadcasters, if there even is such a thing anymore, is one, make it your own. Have a good day. make something your own.
Mm-hmm.
The other is get a job in a town where the NAB is holding its convention, or any radio in any radio group.
Yeah.
So I was hired by Doubleday, the book publishing company. They had a broadcast division. They owned a station in Minneapolis, and I went to Minneapolis for a while, where it was very cold. And then Kevin hired me in Philadelphia, and that was a fascinating thing. The station had originally been known as WIBG, which ostensibly stood for I Believe in God. Its original broadcast license was issued before there was an FCC. It was issued by Commerce Director J. Edgar Hoover.
Wow. Holy shit. Okay.
And it hung on the wall in frames, in a series of frames that went down the business hallway of the radio station. A historic building, a wonderful place in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And I worked with Kevin there and some other wonderful friends and talented people. It was later, it would at some point be called Wizard 100 and played top 40 rock, I think. It leaned more rock, but it was a top 40 station. And at one point, the management decided it wasn't making any money, and they were going to change it to a disco station.
Huh.
I did not take that well. This company, Fairbanks Broadcasting, unbelievable organization. We gave away, one of our promotions, we gave away a Rolls Royce.
Wow.
What we didn't tell people is that it needed. We actually had it in the Thanks Gimbel's Day parade, this Rolls Royce that we were giving away, and it broke down in the parade. I have a photograph of a clown looking under the hood to try to figure out a guy in a clown suit. We got it. We're called Wizard 100, right? So you think, okay, their mascot's a wizard. No, the company got a deal on a beaver suit.
Wow,
so our mascot for Wizard 100 was a beaver. I mean, if this doesn't tell you how insane radio management could be,
yeah, I know.
This was it. And when they went disco, I unfortunately spoke my mind.
Okay.
And said, I think, and this is what I said to the program director and the people who had announced the change, the management who announced, called us in to announce the change. I said, my opinion, I think disco is going to end up in the corner over there with leisure suits and mood rings.
As you're there in Philadelphia in the 1970s,
right.
Had
right.
The movement toward freeform rock radio already kind of hit the East Coast, or was that still exclusively kind of a West Coast thing and it never really
happened? I wasn't aware of it. I mean, I stayed sort of isolated in my world. I did dabble on an FM sort of freeform station in Wichita before I left there.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved with a talk show there and had friends and that sort of thing, hung out there. Listened to them, certainly. New Orleans had such a station. When I was there, it was WNOE, which the NOE stood for no. NOE, as in Governor No. We always had to say WNOE, a Governor James A. No station, when we identified it. No is the governor who took over after the corrupt Huey P. Long was gone.
Oh, okay.
This place was in the French Quarter, which was just great. Made it very convenient for Mardi Gras. And I remember, if I brings back so many stories, I don't want to keep you too long, but it was Mardi Gras, and the AM DJ on the AM side, the top 40 side, was leaning out the window. There was an openable window there, and he was leaning out the window smoking a joint. And over on the FM side, he also had an openable window, and that disc jockey was leaning out the window smoking a joint. Unfortunately, there was no window in the news booth, but the newsroom office had a window, but it wouldn't open.
Yeah.
So I went to the stairwell. I went to the stairwell where there was an off window that would open, and used that. Only I didn't calculate wind air circulation very well, because instead of the smoke going out the window as it was for the DJs, mine drifted down the stairwell and into the lobby where the general manager, his wife, and children had just arrived. This was a Saturday, right?
Oh,
during Mardi Gras. So I hear nothing about it. And one day I get in the elevator with then program director E. Alvin Davis, and the doors close, and it's just the two of us in the elevator. And as the elevator's going up from the first to the second floor, he says, if you get caught smoking weed in the building again, I don't think I'm going to be able to save your job.
That's so great.
The door opened, and we went our separate ways. I never heard about it again until my exit interview with the general manager, who was a cross between Orson Welles and Colonel Sanders.
Jesus.
He wore bow ties that his wife made for him, and he spoke with a big Southern accent, this guy did. And he said, when you go to Minneapolis, they're not going to let you smoke weed up there.
Oh, shit. Well, that's...
He was, of course, wrong, but...
I was going to say, I mean, that even in my day, even when I was working in broadcast radio, substance usage at radio stations was still a rampant, ongoing thing, and
It would get worse for others around me, and I won't get into that because I don't want to incriminate anybody or denigrate anybody, for that matter, because I worked with an awful lot of good people. There was obviously a serious side. I mean, I was inspired at KLAO back in Wichita by Woodward and Bernstein and the whole Watergate story.
Yeah.
One of the first big stories I covered was the end of the Vietnam War, the signing of the peace accord that ended the war. And then the next big story after that was, of course, Watergate. And you talk about those old teletype machines. I still have the strips of paper that I tore off the wire where they'd say, a flash, Nixon resigns. I've got that strip of paper from from the UPI wire, along with other significant things in history that I've witnessed.
And you had pretty much carte blanche in the 70s at some of those early radio stations to choose whatever news stories you thought were important and you could prioritize. There was no mandate in terms of, well, avoid this kind of crap. Don't get too political.
Almost my entire... Really, for all intents and purposes, my entire career was influence-free as far as influence from sponsors or managers. Mm-hmm. I had one incident later in my career that, again, I don't want to put anybody in a tough spot. They did what they had to do. I did what I had to do. Mm-hmm. But the rest of my time was pressure and influence free. Many of the stations where I would work, I was the news department. Yeah. I was the news director, and I was the only employee of that department in many cases. And in cases, in the case of the first radio station where there was a staff, they would, I just kind of knew how to behave. I mean, nobody ever came to me and said, do this, do that. But I knew basically what kinds of stories they were covering, what should be covered. But I mostly you're in the room by yourself, so you get to decide.
Yeah.
And I never had any trouble with that. I do remember breaking format on things that I remember in clever ways, though, in clever ways that worked, that didn't really go against the spirit of the format, but violated the letter of the format. I can't think of a specific example, except that I remember the newsroom door flying open and the program director sticking his head in and saying, if that were anybody else. And so I got away with a lot of stuff that way. And then I got to be a news director with a staff, so I had that experience. But many of the experiences were just, I play well by myself. I was an only child, so I'm cool with that. I can do that.
Was there any occasion where you just royally fucked up, where you did something and you thought it was right at the time, and then you hear about it maybe that day the program director sticks his head back in the door again and says something to you, or what?
Nothing that I got in trouble for, nothing that I got called for, but I know of mistakes. In Chicago one time, I reported on a verdict that hadn't been delivered yet.
Oh no.
Fortunately, I was right.
Oh, see? There.
and even more fortunately, nobody said anything. It's Chicago.
Yeah.
So, I got away with that. It seemed like there was one other sort of big mistake. Well, I guess it was, it goes to the incident that I cited where there was influence from management to do an interview with somebody who was also a sponsor. In this case, the sponsor was a government agency. Mm-hmm. And the management was offering what they called value added at the time, and they had included me in their little value add, and then I was to do an interview that I was opposed to doing, and I did it, and I was fierce, and I was mean. I was Mike Wallace. I was all over this guy, and I got to the end of it and realized it hadn't stuck to the tape.
No, no.
Yeah, and so I got in all kinds of trouble for that, but it wasn't, this too shall pass, and it did.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, those are the only two big mistakes that come to mind. I mean, I've made little ones. When I was working in Chicago, I got a call one day from the news director, I guess, of the ABC television news office in Chicago. Mm-hmm. At the time, ABC had a three-anchor format where it was Peter Jennings in New York, Max Robinson in Chicago, and Frank Reynolds in Washington, something mm-hmm. like that. And this was the studio where Max Reynolds did his set, and he was out sailing one day, so the facility was available. And I got a call from the news director who asked me about a mistake I'd made. I said, I'm here by myself. You got me. It was some small thing, mm-hmm. He just wanted to know why I made it. And then he said, how would you like to come down and cut an audition tape?
Shit, really?
What the ABC television network, the ABC News, the national network, wants me to come downtown. Oh, gosh. And when I completed the taping, I mean, they dedicated the teleprompter guy and everybody to me. I had the access to the whole staff. I wrote the script, and sat down at the desk, and they did the lighting and the teleprompter and the makeup and rolled the tape, and I did my audition tape thanks to the guy who was running ABC, the bureau in Chicago, bureau chief, I guess it was. And I drove home on a cloud on Lakeshore Drive. Yeah. It was, I think, the highest moment I've ever felt. Now, nothing came of it, of course. And I did send copies of the tape around the country to smaller markets like Kansas City and that sort of thing, thinking. But at the time, I still had a bit of a fro, a bit of an afro. And I had a very neatly trimmed beard, which we weren't doing on TV yet. So yeah, yeah. I had, at the time, by those standards, a rough appearance that I think probably kept me, but it's a good audition to this day. I feel good about it.
And you know what? I think I've seen it. I think when I was interning for you at JFK, I went to your house one night and had dinner with you. Yeah, you and Marshall.
I made you watch it.
Yeah, yes. I did. I saw it. I remember distinctly seeing it. And one of the things that impressed me was the fact that you were able to read a prompter. That's not the easiest thing in the world. That's a major adjustment from doing news on the radio, is now you've got to stare into a camera. You've got to do all the tricks that we see in broadcast news with sitting on the jacket and all the rest of it. Was that intimidating? I mean, were you able to practice on a prompter in some way?
It was something I felt I knew, and my feeling was correct. Yeah. I knew I could do it. I knew I would do it. I knew it would be good, and it was, and I did, and that was all there was to it. I guess I'm sort of a natural at that, although I feel like I've had that instinct since I was like 6 years old.
Yeah.
It was just what I was made to do. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because in the final years of my newscast, especially as the scripts got longer and longer, oh man, did they get long. They were typed in large print on a document, like a Word document. And I would scroll it myself as I read it, teleprompter style, doing the news.
In
the final years. So I ended up reading a teleprompter, even if it wasn't on TV.
Yeah.
I had a face that was perfect for radio, apparently.
Oh, man. Well, that's, again, as I said, that must have been so exhilarating at all at once.
It was.
Disappointing because it didn't really evolve in anything.
Yeah, but see, the exhilaration came like a punch, you know. Yeah. It came powerfully and all at once. The disappointment was trickled out over time.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It wasn't quite as devastating, you know, and not terrible. And you know what? The other thing I want to say is I ended up preferring radio. And you say, well, sure, he preferred it. He couldn't get on in TV. No, I prefer it because it is pretty autonomous that if you screw up, it's on you.
Yeah.
In television, if you screw up, there could be six other people involved in that screw up.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the terrible things that can happen to TV anchors on the air because somebody, the prompter operator or whoever, screws up, or some piece of equipment out of the anchor's control screws up.
Yeah.
Well, you just don't have that problem so much in radio. You've got control of everything.
Yeah, and in fact, that's one of the reasons why I don't do video to go along with my show right now, because there's that extra dimension, the visual dimension that you have to be aware of and constantly thinking about and adjusting for, and I don't have that level of coordination. I just can't do it. I can't coordinate the vocal aspect of it, the thought aspect of it, and then the visual aspect. It's just one thing too many.
I got shouted down once by Don Geronimo. We were doing a remote somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area, and they had us on camera, you know, just like closed circuit in the club or wherever we were, a restaurant, wherever we were doing this remote. And so the camera was on me during the news segment. So although I did not have a teleprompter, I read from the script to the camera, old style, the way anchors did it, like in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And Geronimo came over and said, "What are you doing? What are you doing?
Shit.
Why are you, you know?" So I had to like not look at the camera and finish the newscast. But I enjoy doing it. It just comes naturally to me. I my eyes go right to the center of the camera and I go.
One of many incidences where you're offered a direction and no rhyme or reason for the direction.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah,
and that would happen from program directors and even general managers from time to time. You know, you'd realize, oh, this guy has no clue what he's talking about.
Well, speaking of Geronimo, I guess we can get back into the time. How did you end up landing in Chicago? Was that Was that your next step? I mean, was that, because that's kind of, we're into the early 80s now, right?
So I mentioned this Tom Birch guy back in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Well, he was programming a station in Oklahoma, and there was a woman who worked there by the name of Karen Hand. And one day Tom Birch gave her a tape of my newscast and said, listen to this and learn from this guy.
Wow.
And I was not aware of any of this, right?
Yeah.
And so Karen listens, and she loves it. And she said, oh, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to do what this guy does. And so she sort of trained herself to do what I do, kind of the way I do it. And as it turns out, I was in Chicago. I don't remember how, I guess air checks. The San Diego station fell apart. It went from Philadelphia to San Diego. Oh. After my leisure suit comment, I asked the program director directly, do I have a future here? And he said, frankly, no. And so I went home feeling pretty dejected, you know, because I knew firing was imminent. And I went home, and as I'm opening the apartment door, the phone's ringing, and it's a program director in San Diego wants me to send a tape.
Incredible.
And I got hired there. And I loved Southern California. You know, I would have liked to have ended up there, but it's expensive, and it keeps catching on fire, and then mudslides put out the fire.
Yeah. But I mean, what's impressive is that you actually were recruited, and that so seldom happens in radio, at least from my experience.
I was the same way with radio stations that I was with girls. I waited for them to come to me.
Yeah, it's like Larry King. But make them call you. Don't call them.
but they have to call you. It wasn't about that, really. It was a fear of rejection, I think, in both cases. And also sort of the attitude, look, I've got a job. I'll do the best job that I can with it. And if it leads to something else, cool.
Yeah.
That's great. And, you know, and I talked about the serious reasons that I pursued journalism, but there was also being associated with Top 40 and rock radio. There was a very showbiz aspect to a lot of my years. And a lot of my years, I was kind of in it for the sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
and
yeah,
so,
of course.
So it's a multi-layered career. but I don't remember how I – oh, yeah, with Karen Hand.
Yeah.
Somehow I ended up in Chicago. I don't recall how, maybe through air checks. Worked at a radio station owned by the Mormons for a while that played music everybody could agree on, even the boss. And I remember the news director there. I worked for a news director there. I was not completely autonomous. I didn't get bossed around a lot. My work was autonomous. But he put me on probation on the same week that I won the Associated Press Award for the best regularly scheduled newscast.
Incredible.
And so I was both an award winner and on probation all at the same time.
But the probation was not because you were being punished, was it? It was just because they were testing you out, right?
You know, I don't know. No, I think it was a warning. I think it was, you know, whatever it was, and I don't even recall.
Okay.
It was like you do something like that again and you're out.
I think
it was that kind of a probation.
I see.
So I was both under threat of firing and winning awards for the station all in the same week.
Jesus.
It's a very Keith Olbermann kind of existence.
Fucking radio, man. Yeah.
Oh, I know. It's insane. And anyway, somehow I get a call from Karen Hand. I guess I send out feelers in town. Because I'm tired of moving.
Because
I've gone from Wichita to New Orleans to Minneapolis
up and down the dial. Yeah.
To San Diego to Chicago. And Karen Hand calls and goes, oh, I'd love to hire you. And she and I ended up, she was pregnant at the time. And so she was away. I was the sole anchor for a while. And then she returned and we co-anchored. And together we were the best co-anchor team radio ever saw.
Wow.
We were a well-oiled machine. It was so much fun, and we did so much good work there together, and had sort of newsroom discussions that you and I would ultimately have at JFK, but just did some really good work. And Chicago is just a blast, and I was there probably I was there longer than any place other than DC.
And then
suddenly at the age of 35, on my 35th birthday, the program director, Buddy Scott, called me into his office and said, I guess you know this isn't working out. And I did not know that. And I was stunned, and I was let go. The ratings were, I guess, not what they hoped for, and I was the scapegoat for it.
Was there focus group testing at that point? I mean, how were they able to pinpoint it down to you and Karen?
Buddy said one time, I remember saying, he goes, someday I'm going to have a big readout on the wall. And I'll be able to see exactly how people react to everything the DJ says. And if the DJ says something that pisses people off, I can pull them off the air. I mean, that's the kind of madness that was at work there. I mean, he just knew nothing about managing people, sadly. Mm. Nice guy otherwise, but I guess. But anyway, I did not know that. And on my 35th birthday, I was an unemployed unemployed from a top 40 radio station. DJ, I guess. And so I sent out tapes. I was unemployed for 7 months. And talk about feeling depressed and dejected. I mean, it was a horrible experience that I understand people who go for long periods without being able to find work, what that's like. And in radio, it's even tougher because you take it personally.
Yeah.
It means they don't like you if they're not hiring you.
Yeah.
And that's, and you like being liked is what you're in it for.
And it's a lot easier to get hired someplace else if you're actually working at a radio station when you get hired at the other place, right?
That, and I would hear that again. I ended up in Albany, New York as a morning DJ.
Yeah. Working
for a company. I mean, I sent out air checks. I had worked as a DJ and a newsman at that point. And so desperate for work, 7 months, I was sending out air checks all over the country, even to Guam, any place but Detroit. I was open to going to. I finally got a job as a morning DJ in Albany, New York. And the interesting thing, the only thing I'll say about that company is that at one point, it was the whole station was spectacular, but it was opened on a bank loan, on a $10 million loan. And the owner defaulted on the loan. And so the radio station was taken over by the bank. And then something went horribly wrong at the bank, and the bank was taken over by the FDIC. So at one point, I was a federal DJ.
Okay, we'll get back to our encore conversation with Buzz Burbank here in just 1 second. But first, here's Stephanie Miller.
OMG, I am using a new skincare system that I absolutely love. People say puffiness and bags under the eyes are the hardest things to get rid of. Until now, introducing Genucel plant stem cell therapy from Chamonix, specifically targeting eye puffiness and bags. Due to new technology, Genucel is an incredibly powerful natural serum. And with its instant effects, it's guaranteed to show results in as little as 12 hours or your money back. That's right. Users saw results in only 12 hours with dramatic improvement in 2 weeks. A true Chamonix classic, Genucel contains 8 extra ingredients to significantly reduce the appearance of bags and puffiness. Plus, Genucel uses patented plant stem cell technology to improve longevity and brilliant long-term results. You can try Genucel right now, absolutely risk-free. Go to lovegenucel.com/Stephanie. Enter that special promo code Stephanie for an extra 10% off. Order now and get the legendary Genucel XV face cream absolutely free just for trying Genucel today. Chamonix, the best skincare, best results, or your money back. That's lovegenucel, GENUCEL.com/Stephanie. lovegenucel.com/Stephanie.
The Bob Seska Show.
You know, I'm hearing these stories and I'm thinking, even in its glory days, radio was held together with gum and scotch tape.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's when I heard from Geronimo, who said, you know, we want to share the wealth. Come on down and work with us. I had been on a morning show network where guys shared bits, you know, comedy bits that they developed another, so that I could write a top 5 list and it would be used all over the country. My specialty, and the other guys on the network loved this, was writing monologue jokes, believe it or not. You can't tell it from your show, but at one point I was writing genuinely funny monologue jokes that you would hear later that night on the Tonight Show and Letterman and so on. But I had the opportunity to get them out there sooner.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was able to use them. And the other disc jockeys loved these one-liners because they were short enough you could read over the lip of a record, over the intro of a record. So that's how Geronimo knew I was out there and what I was capable of, and had me, because I'd worked with him in Chicago. He was one of the 6 morning men I'd worked with there during my time there.
So typical.
So I went down to D.C., and ultimately we'd get to work in New York City as well. So for a guy from Wichita, when I signed off in Wichita, my last newscast, I said, but I'll be back if I have to use ABC, NBC, or CBS to do it.
And
in the end, it was CBS that distributed the Don and Mike show across the country and allowed me to work in New York and broadcast nationwide.
So you ended up back with Don Geronimo at WJFK in, right. What was that, 1991 or so? Is it 91?
Yeah, 91. I think December 90, something like that. Yeah, so for all intents and purposes, 91.
Yeah.
That was a funny deal. Ken Stevens, some people will remember, the name,
yeah,
some won't.
Yeah.
But he was the general manager at the time that I was hired. He heard my tape. He called me. He said, you don't suck. Which I thought was, I knew I was in,
asshole,
you know, when I heard that.
Yeah.
And then I worked there for a month, and they put me up in a hotel near the airport. And we lived in, and we had the VCR, and they brought in an extra refrigerator. They let us have the cats. We had plants, live plants with us that we'd crammed into this hotel room where we actually wrapped, because it was December. We did our Christmas wrapping on the beds there,
mm-hmm,
you know, to send out gifts to people around the country. But I lived there for like a month at the hotel, and we were waiting for our reimbursement check, I guess, and also waiting for my first paycheck. And after like a month, I went into the general manager's office, and I said, when can I expect that first paycheck? And he goes, you haven't been paid yet?
Shock. I can't believe it. That's such an outrage. Yeah.
So he sent me down to the comptroller's office, who got me set up, and the money started pouring in.
Yeah,
You know, the reimbursements and the back pay and all the things that had built up. Somehow we managed to stay afloat during that period of time, but that was a funny start to a career there.
So it was Don brought you in, but it was really WJFK that hired you. So you were kind of loaned out to other shows on that station, right? So you were doing news for Gordon Liddy, right?
Right, and, Gordon Liddy, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So that,
yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah.
I was part of his 25th anniversary Watergate break-in show. I went with G. Gordon Liddy.
Jesus Christ.
Let me say this again. I went with G. Gordon Liddy to the Watergate Hotel.
Oh my
God. Where we did a show. I have an ashtray that you will someday inherit.
Okay.
That says the Watergate Hotel.
Wow.
It's a very, very nice ashtray.
Oh my God.
I actually was part of that. And then a tug of war would ensue between Liddy and Geronimo. And because Geronimo brought me down there, and because he was very powerful and influential, because his show was such a moneymaker for the network that. Mm-hmm. He got his way, you'd think it would be fun to have people fighting over you, and you'd think, well, you know, bid high, bid to buy, but it really wasn't pleasant at all. And I left out a part of the story in Albany after that radio station fell apart, you know, taken over by the bank, taken over by the feds, etc. Started looking for work again, came across Geronimo. Ken Stevens heard the tape, said it didn't suck, but then we were waiting, and it's like Thanksgiving Eve, and I don't know what we're doing. You know, I'm unemployed. I've given my, you know, I've got a truck lined up, and so I called my agent. I had an agent at that point, you know, for ever since Chicago. I called my agent and said, what do I do? Well, I've got the truck's going to be loaded tomorrow. Where do I point it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a plan B in case there was no job.
I
was going to go back to Wichita, of all places, until, you know, I could come up with something. But so I called the agent. I said, where do I point the truck? And he said, why don't you drive it on down to D.C.?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, we got the job? And he goes, why don't you drive it on down to D.C.?
Shit.
That's how tenuous my hiring was at WJFK that would lead to this incredible, amazing job where I got to do Theater of the Mind through the Don and Mike show and be part of that. And, oh, my gosh, how gratifying that was, and how gratifying to be part of a show that was that big. I owe Don in particular thanks for providing that opportunity. I feel less thankful because of what many of us who worked with him and for him had to endure during the years that followed.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't want to get into the details of that, but for all the greatness of it, there was a good deal of
stress.
What's the right word? Yeah, stress.
Demoralization.
Yeah, a little of that. Yeah, a sprinkle of that. But it was tough. It was tougher than it looked. And I know it was an amazing show that means so much, that meant so much to so many people.
Me
and
included.
I get it. Yeah. I totally get it. I do. I don't quite share the same feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember first hearing you on that show and thinking, oh, this guy, Buzz Burbank, he's the new David Haynes, because that's who I was familiar with doing the news on the old Don and Mike Morning Zoo at WAVA in Washington. Right. They had this guy, David Haynes. When you were asked to use the radio name Buzz Burbank, which happened when you went to WJFK in Washington, what was your reaction to that name? Because you, up to that point, you had never used any name but your own name. Were you embracing of that idea, being called Buzz Burbank, or were you bristling at it?
You know, yes, of course. I mean, when your livelihood depends on it, and someone asks you or someone tells you that's going to be your name, you say, yes, sir. Yes, it is. That is my name. Mm-hmm. That is correct. And you just I didn't really care for the name. I associate the name Buzz with somebody like an astronaut or somebody who has a buzz cut. You know, I picture that's the kind of buzz I picture when I hear the name Buzz.
Mm-hmm.
That could just be me. Yeah. And I know it's taken on new meanings since then. But at the same time, I have to say the name has been very, very good to me.
Yeah.
And I eventually registered it as an AKA with my banks and financial institutions, so that should anyone write a check to Buzz Burbank, that I would be able to sign it and cash it.
Yeah, yeah. And so did Liddy also call you Buzz Burbank, or did he?
He did. Buzz.
Buzz, okay.
It's a happy shop we have here, Buzz.
See, I'm pegging him as being uncomfortable with it, too. Like, that's not something that he would do necessarily.
No, because that's he probably knew guys named Buzz. I mean, I don't think that would be incongruous for him at all.
Yeah, okay.
No, he had no problem with that, and for all he knew, that was my name.
So, yeah, so I ended up joining you in the newsroom in 1993. In fact, I first started working as an intern for Don and Mike specifically for that spring semester, but I found myself more and more often gravitating toward you and the more comfortable environment of the newsroom as opposed to the broadcast studio, which never
for
quite...
For which I am very grateful, because you were the first intern mature enough and interested enough in what was going on my side of the glass. And it was just nice to have somebody to talk to, you know, because you're a little isolated from the main control room in that situation. But no, you were just the right guy. You know, you were you deserved, unlike any others, you deserved to be there. I wanted to make the most of it for you.
Yeah, and I was still new enough to not be toxic yet. So that was another upside. Another reason we got along is because at that point, I was still very, you know, wet behind the ears. The first time I ever cracked the microphone publicly on my college radio station was like 4 months before that. And so I was brand new. I was completely green.
Good,
and so
we got you early.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's one of the reasons why, and I mentioned this in the commentary last week, one of the reasons why, and of course it has so much to do with you as well and your professionalism and your talent as a broadcaster, but that was one of the reasons why you were so incredibly influential on my overall style, which, you know, has a, you know, a little bit of Howard Stern in there, a little bit of Don Geronimo in there, a little bit of David Letterman in there, and we have that in common. We have that influence of David Letterman that I think was one of the first entryways into our friendship, where we would, you know, be in the newsroom talking about Letterman bits, whether they were happening last night on the show or, you know, years and years earlier on, he was doing.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Maybe people have noticed this, like when I'm doing jokes or even talking on your show.
Yeah.
A lot of times I am sort of channeling him. Not on purpose. I have to tell you, the first time I saw Letterman, and fell in love with his work, is that he was saying what I was thinking, and he was looking at things the way I was looking at things. And so I just really identified with that. And I've always admired his humility.
Yeah.
And I've learned from that. I think another great teacher of humility has been from The Daily Show, John Stewart.
Yeah.
And he taught it to John Oliver, and he taught it to Stephen Colbert. And now they are the same kind of incredible, wonderful bosses that John Stewart was. And that really underscores the influence you can have on somebody. And I hope my influence has been positive on you. I still haven't gotten over the things you said about me, and I, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how to respond.
Well, you know what? It's strange. I feel like whatever it was that I said, I feel like it wasn't enough. And not to get too soupy here or anything like that, but I got to the end of it and I was like, you know, I could probably do another 5,000 words.
It was the longest. It was the longest commentary you've ever submitted to Buzz Burbank News and Comment. At 7 minutes, I thought it had gone on plenty long.
That's true.
You know, but I did hear from a lot of people, and I know you have too, who said, "Yeah, you said it very well, or you said it very nicely." I guess to some degree, I was a little surprised at just the level of sort of admiration that you were showing for me there, and that caught me a little bit more off guard. I mean, I knew you admired me on some levels. That really went down the list and knocked me over.
Well, I mean, admired, yeah, absolutely. I flagrantly stole from you as soon as I left WJFK and went back to college. I was in college for another two semesters, graduated, and then got my first job in radio mid-1994. And part of that was doing the news, because I was hired at an AM full-service radio station where I would play music and I would read, public service announcements, and I would do the news, and I was eventually able to do I did the first iteration of the Bob Seska Show on that radio station, and you did all of the bumpers for me, I remember. I'd call you up and you'd send me a reel. It was obviously before the internet, and you would send me a reel of all these different things saying something about the Bob Seska Show, and so I used that. But I mean, when I was doing the news, I was channeling you. I was thinking, I would even sit at the microphone in the newsroom or in the broadcast booth the same way that you would do it, because that was really 1,000% my experience. What's that?
I don't get that. How did I sit? What is that like?
Well, there was something. I remember one time, it was not during the news, but I remember one time you were sitting so politely with your hands folded in front of you on the desk. And I remember we had talked about that. I said, that's interesting. You look very polite, Buzz. And you say, yeah, I'm feeling very polite, or something along those lines. So I used to sit like that myself when I was delivering the news, because partly I'm half Italian, so my hands are flailing around otherwise. And so,
over the years, I've added gestures. I did gestures when I would do the news. Yeah. And part of the reason for that is because Marcia would be sitting right across from me.
Uh-huh.
And so I was making eye contact with her as I was reading my little teleprompter on the computer screen in front of me to record the newscast. And so I would gesture. But I did begin to gesture more over the years. I felt like maybe it added something to the audio delivery of what I was saying to be able to do that. But it's also very good discipline to sit neatly with your hands folded.
Yes, well, it was also the way you ran the board and the way you cued a cart with an actuality on it. All those things are things that I picked up on, and still extent I still utilize the same sort of process with a board and everything like that, sound effects. I still have similar motions that have their origins in watching you do it and imitating you. Even some of the verbal things, like wrapping up the newscast with one final kicker story and starting out with, "And finally," and I would do, I'm Bob Seska on WEEU. I'm Buzz Burbank. I would do the same cadence. And it was just directly.
I'm actually glad for most of those things, because I would hope that I would be able to share some of my knowledge with somebody else, just as at that very first radio station. I'll never forget Rick Gannon, disc jockey, who, again, no longer with us, but he's the man who taught me how to splice tape.
We
edit much differently today. We do it electronically on screen on our computers, but it's actually very much the same.
Oh yeah.
But he taught me how to use a razor blade and splice tape and edit things. And I like to think I became pretty good at that. And the thanks goes to the guy who didn't have to take the time to teach me that.
That's right.
There was nothing in it for him. there was no reason for him to help this guy other than he believed in this guy.
Yeah.
And wow, yeah. That's just everything, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I still remember the little ditty you taught me about a reel-to-reel tape. And it was, you know, what you do in radio is there's different colored tape that you use on the reel to hold it together. So at the very front of the tape, you use, or at the very front of the actual audio tape, you use a piece of red tape and you put that at the head. And then you use the blue tape to secure it in the middle to the right. actual plastic of the reel. And so the right. ditty was redhead, blue tail fly. And so that's I still, right. that's something I still remember to this day. And I remember the exactly that where one. I was standing in the WJFK newsroom when you imparted that little ditty to me.
Well, and Bob, that's invaluable information because if reels of tape ever come back into our lives, you're I going know. To know that rule. So help. I'm glad. I may as well have taught you algebra. Yeah,
So just, I don't know how you are on time. Just a couple more things here. So Don retired after a terrible, terrible family tragedy.
Tragedy, indeed.
And so the Don and Mike show disappeared and became the Mike O'Mara show on WJFK for a couple of years. And then that became a podcast after it was no longer viable on WJFK.
Am I skipping over a lot, right? No, I would take issue with whether it was viable. Okay. Management made a decision to cut the overhead.
I see.
They had a lot of well-paid personalities who were well-paid because they were very good and they brought ratings. And after years, decades of telling us that ratings were everything, one day management came in and said, ratings don't count anymore.
Oh, shit.
It's strictly revenue. Mm-hmm. We're going sports with some young kids who will give their left arm to be on the radio and will pay us to let them be on the radio, so we have to pay them very little.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to save a gazillion dollars, and we'll be able to sell beer ads and tire ads because we're sports. So suddenly, when ratings were everything, one day ratings were nothing. And so that is why the Mike O'Mara show and other shows like it vanished from WJFK and were replaced by cheap sports.
And, you know, it's a shame that it had to go away the way it did because, you know, for all intents and purposes, I think Mike did a pretty good job. And obviously with your help and Rob's help.
Yeah,
the show was pretty good and actually kind of filled the same Don and Mike itch. It's kind of scratched the same itch that the old Don and Mike right. show did. It just had it didn't have Don as part of it. And maybe that was, I don't know, the fly in the ointment. But, you know, I thought it was a decent show. And then it became a podcast after JFK went sports.
A very successful one, I might
add.
I mean, for the time that I was there, we were making pretty good dough considering it was a pie. I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah.
And Mark Ronick, who would later steer the Realm Network,
is
responsible for monetizing that newscast, that podcast company or that particular podcast, the Mike O'Mara Show, suddenly started making money. And I'm proud to say I brought Mark aboard. I said, hey, anybody see this resume we got from a guy named Mark Ronick? And no, they hadn't. And we brought him in and we talked to him and we hired him. And suddenly we were making, like I said, pretty amazing money for just a dumb podcast.
Yeah.
And but people loved it and a lot of subscribers and it made good money. And but it was... at a certain point, I'd had enough, and I called my financial advisor, started calling her regularly, and said, "Can I retire yet?" And she'd say, "Well, no, not yet."
Yeah, you know?
And every couple of months, I'd call her and ask her this, because I was really done, with doing that particular thing. And one day, I called, and I said, "Can I retire yet?" And she said, "Well, yeah, maybe." And I said, "Perfect. That's all I need to hear. Thank you." And I gave my final notice and left the show. And I wish it could have been received more pleasantly. And I'm sorry that it wasn't. I miss.
That's
at least one of those folks.
Right. And, you know, look, that's one of the major differences between the podcast universe and the broadcast universe. And broadcasting was very toxic in terms of interactions with certainly competing DJs, but maybe even DJs who are on your same station, where it was just very, very cutthroat, very resentful environment. And podcasting seems, and I don't know if this is necessarily your experience from the Mike O'Mara podcast, but it seemed like podcasting was a little more amicable in terms of dealing with people.
It's a more intimate medium because we were interacting more with people online, mm-hmm. and so you really could get feedback and personal involvement. Radio being to that point the most intimate medium there was, podcasting became the most intimate medium, and so that was cool and exciting and a lot of fun and another factor in its success.
Was it an adjustment for you going from broadcast to podcasting? Were you,
strange or weird? It's just like being on the radio. And so was my podcast, which is a newscast, and so is doing your show. Mm-hmm. It feels exactly the same as doing radio to me. And as long as there are people out there who get some enjoyment, and sometimes I'll get off of what I perceive as a joke, and one person in the audience will get it and contact me about it. And for me, that just makes it completely worthwhile.
Yeah.
Because I've reached somebody. And I love the idea. I'm theatrical. I'm a theatrical person.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of making someone laugh, mm-hmm. making someone cry, making someone angry about something, about a cause.
You've done all those things in the past week, I think. I think I'm just marking a checklist.
And it's only Wednesday, so...
The unfortunate thing to me, and to be brutally honest, is one of the things that was disappointing about the separation from the Mike O'Mara show was that I think, and I don't know if this is even in Mike's defense, but I feel like some of that animosity that he took in from his years in broadcasting extended into the world of podcasting, that maybe that was just his... You know,
that was
his
the exception.
Education, his experiences that came to the forefront at that point.
People who had lofty radio jobs, not just Mike, but also Don, and I'm sure others as well, people who had lofty radio jobs and then didn't have them anymore, expected, demanded the same things from the podcasting world that the broadcasting world had given them, and it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
This is a much more humble medium still.
Yeah.
And it's not the same, and you can't expect it to be the same, and you will be uncomfortable and unhappy if you do.
Were you satisfied with the reaction to news and comment? Because, again, it is a different environment, and you and I both, I think to a certain extent, and you can absolutely say this about the Mike O'Mara podcast, there's so much radio influence that's brought into the podcasting world through your program, through my program. That's all we know, or at least speak for myself.
These are radio
shows. Yeah, exactly. I'm basically doing radio on the internet. Exactly what it is. To quote Silicon Valley on HBO, I'm doing radio on the internet. Is there a resistance to that, or did you find that people were like, podcasting buzz is a different universe, and you'd get notes saying maybe be a little more this or that, which is
nothing about notes. Older people were obviously more shy about getting into podcasting, although more of them have now, which is great. So there was that sort of foot dragging at first on the part of older listeners. It just doesn't reach as many people. Only a few podcasts reach sort of the lofty numbers. Hi, Stephanie, that you get from radio shows.
Yeah,
it's in that respect, it's just not the same. And I was doing a very niche thing. I went from going from a full service show, the Mike O'Mara show, to only the people who care about the news part.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the audience was sizably smaller.
Yeah.
When I first began, but it did build over time to a very gratifying level, and certainly you were a big part in helping that happen. See what happens when you help somebody who's on their way up?
Yeah,
it's just
there you
awesome because they can help you out later. So and you did, and I'm so grateful. grateful for that. And it's just, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know, I'm happy to have the smaller audiences in podcasting than as opposed to broadcasting, in exchange for not having to deal with program directors. That's yes. the big bonus.
That and the intimacy. I mean, yeah. I've made friends over the years on mm-hmm. social media who listen to my shows and have been very, very supportive of me, both personally and professionally. Oh my gosh, what a gratifying experience that was, far more than anything I ever experienced in radio, and that was pretty lofty.
So what's next? What do you have planned? Because obviously we're going to keep working together on Tuesdays, but
I alluded to this on your regular show yesterday that I really haven't had much of a moment to appreciate the fact that I'm retired.
Yeah.
I did actually go with some friends to safely, socially distanced to a beach mm-hmm. on Sunday, which was very nice. So I got a few hours respite there. But I spent a good deal of my time this morning still making arrangements for my folks, taking care of little business details for yeah. them. I'm in the middle of working on my taxes. I'm going to clean out my garage. I'm going to do the things that I never had time to do because the work that I just finished doing was so all-consuming.
Yeah.
I mean, it got to the point in the final days of the Trump administration where my Wednesdays were 13-hour days. That was par for every Wednesday. I could count on a 13-hour day, and it was hard work, gratifying, and I wouldn't have had it any other way. But I'll also tell you, it was hard, and to be sort of free of those 13-hour days is a huge. It's a chance for me to get caught up in my life. But as far as fun stuff goes, absolutely. And I want to get back into my ukulele.
Yeah,
I want to do some writing. I've said before, I want to do some special podcasts. Not ready yet, but mm-hmm. they're coming. I've got stuff on the desktop of my computer right now for specials that I'd like to do. And so I'll get back to those soon enough, as soon as I feel like I've leveled out my life a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. But it must be exciting to have sort of a blank slate ahead of you.
God,
I mean, other
yeah.
than domestic yeah. things, yeah.
Because the guy I have been working for was a jerk. And now I'm
that's that right.
That was me. And now I don't work for that jerk anymore. So, my time is more my own. Or at least it will be when I get some of these other things taken care of.
Well, congratulations on 49 years. And apologies to people with obsessive compulsive disorder that you didn't get to 50. And because everyone's going, 49, Buzz, why couldn't you make it 50? Nice.
I'm one of those people. But, you know, it was the time. And I've laid out the story of what I plan to do. But except for the fact that I got sidetracked, and even the fact that I had to go to Kansas to take care of my folks in that final month.
Yeah.
I'm happy. I'm satisfied with the ending. I got to tie up the story in a pretty neat bow, both mm-hmm. for myself and for my career and for the story that I've been covering so intensely
yeah.
over the last 5 years. And so I'm satisfied that I did get to write the ending that I wanted to write.
What an incredible ending, too. The fact that your last 4 years doing this was this gigantic existential crisis in American
yes.
politics. I mean,
right.
you couldn't
Democracy.
Ask for a better denouement of your entire broadcasting career.
Somebody said on Facebook, you know, way to retire, Buzz, way to retire.
Yeah.
Like, when I announced when it would be, they said, yeah, that's how you do it. That's
well, okay, my friend, it was an absolute pleasure. I could listen to these stories all damn day. In fact, you're very, very lucky that I haven't gone back and tried to get recaps on some of the details in and amongst there. We could have been doing this for another 3 hours.
You know, they're not going to let you smoke marijuana when you get up to Minneapolis.
That's right. Oh, shit. Oh, the good old days.
And I have to say, I am so proud of you and of all your work.
Oh, thank you.
And so grateful for what you've done and said for me. I have not stopped repaying you.
Oh, well, I am so immensely, immensely grateful, not only for that, but of course for, you know, your patience, your tutoring, your just listening to me whine incessantly when I was first starting out in radio. Getting hired, Buzz? I don't understand. Even though I was working at a radio station, I don't know what I was complaining about.
You know, I understood perfectly. And you know, there's another phenomenon just before we go, another phenomenon I discovered in my career, and it's true of any career. One of my interns in Chicago came to me one day and said, She said, I just got hired at such and such radio station, a good station, good job. And I said, I know what's bothering you, because I knew she was troubled.
Yeah.
And I said, I know what's bothering you. I said, you got hired and you don't think you're qualified, do you? And she said, how did you know? And I said, I feel that way every time I got a job.
Right. Yeah. See, I feel that way every time I turn my microphone on. So that's
something I think all of us, regardless of our careers, may have in common.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is thinking we're not up to it and then finding out that we really are.
Oh, my God. Rampant strain of job insecurity, constantly. emotional insecurity in there, too. That's commonality. Every single DJ I have ever met has had the same personality and psychological profile as me.
Love me.
Yeah,
me.
Exactly.
Please love me.
Yeah. Right. That's why, ultimately, if you boil it right down, that's why we do it.
That's why we do it.
My friend, I love you so much, and thank you for everything, and I can't wait to talk to you again on Tuesday.
And I can't wait to talk to you again more off the air, too, because we are friends, and we've got stuff to exchange. So I look forward to that.
Yeah, lots more whining to do, Buzz.
Good. I look forward to it.
Okay.
I relish your whining.
All right.
Thank you, Bob. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Best to Marsha. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.